Commissioners Andy Young, Atlanta, March 17, continue.
Hello.
You want to say something more on the problem beyond integration?
Yeah, I think what we're finding more and more is along the same line that the Negro is the problem child, but that as is true in families, when you finally get down to it, you have problem children because you have problem families. Children usually reflect the problems that the family that exist in the family. And I think when we are raising a ruckus about education, we're really reflecting the fact that that education is inadequate for everybody. When we're raising a fuss about voting rights, it's because I think democracy has become very lax in its political participation. That politically, Americans have not really been responsible. When Negroes demand the right to vote, they're reminding all Americans of the need to vote if our system is going to truly work. Now, we've gotten into so many of these problems, like urban renewal overcrowding of schools and poor city planning because of political bossism rather than representative government. Now, in the South, we see the problem is that we are denied a right to vote. But when we fuss about our denial of the right to vote, we should really remind, and we are really reminding America, of the fact that all Americans are being denied certain rights because they are not actively participating in the political decisions of their community. That when Negroes are given a bad deal in the courts of the South, this isn't just because of race, it's partially because of the court system really needs some readjustment also. That this has been possibly too politically controlled and culturally dominated by region.
It's also a class question there, too.
That's right. That all poor people. Now, the whole question of employment, Negroes are fussing about jobs. And while it's true, Negroes are discriminated against because of race, the real issue is unemployment and automation. And this is not just a race problem. It's a fundamental problem in our whole socioeconomic structure. Now, I think that where the movement is going and where we're trying to go is to help Americans to realize this, that we ought not be battling each other on the race question. And that by battling each other on the race question, we run the danger of really being destroyed by these real problems. I always say that the Roman Empire was destroyed by some of these same problems from within. But I wonder whether they realize them. Now, America has an opportunity to see what its problems are because, well, history has sort of dressed them up in black. That if you really want to know what's wrong with America, you find out what people with black skins are hollering about.
They're the barometer.
Yeah, that's right. Because we're the ones that are on the bottom usually. So I guess this is that I was talking out in Seattle, Washington, with a group of people, and they were complaining about Boeing aircraft out there not having certain government contracts, and it all of a sudden dawned on me that we were talking about the right to vote, and they couldn't see any real relationship between the denial of disfranchisement of Negroes in the South and their situation in Washington. They say, oh, we don't have that problem up here. And then I reminded them that Lockheed Aircraft here in Atlanta has plenty of contracts, government contracts, while Boeing is losing government contracts. And part of this reason is that Richard Russell is chairman of the Armed Forces Committee of the Senate, and in 20-some years in the Senate, he's been able to accumulate such power that not only is he depriving Negroes of their rights, but he's depriving the citizens of Washington of their equal opportunities in government also. Now, I think that when we begin to document this across the country a little more and begin to show people how the Southern political power block strangles our whole concept of democracy, and we can get rid of this, then we might get around to dealing with some of our problems. Our real problems, which are unemployment.
Or is the Southern political power block in the end merely a symptom of something else and not the enemy itself?
Well, I tend to think that it's the enemy itself right now.
Yeah.
Because I think that while the psychology of the South and the say the spiritual and moral dilemma give us the Southern politics, Southern politics maintains this climate. Can you excuse me just a minute?
Mm-hmm. Let's turn for a moment to the philosophy of nonviolence.
Good.
I have a quotation here from Dr. Kenneth Clark about that philosophy. I'll read it to you. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability, while the black nationalists betray pathology and instability. A deeper analysis, however, might reveal that there is also an unrealistic, if not indeed pathological, basis in King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice is bitterness and resentment. The form which such bitterness takes need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion of the spirit seems inevitable. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them places an additional and probably intolerable burden upon them.
Mm-hmm.
You know that line of argument.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that line of argument? How do you counter it?
Well, intellectually, I think two ways. One is that I think Dr. Clark is reflecting a particularly almost behavioristic view of man. And a psychologist generally see man maybe more biologically than spiritually. That now some of your more recent schools, this fellow from Vienna that developed this whole system of logotherapy out of his concentration camp experiences would say that people need that his whole method is not the release and expression of hostility, but that maybe greater discipline ought to be required in situations where sickness is imminent. He uses the illustration of an ark. When it's beginning to crumble, one of the things that you can do to keep it together is put more weight at the center of it, and this actually binds the pieces together. And I think this would be our experience in nonviolence. That and my experience in child rearing too, that I'm not one of these that while a certain amount of expression is necessary, I just don't believe in letting hostilities run rampant. And I think this is what's implied, that you're much more healthy when you express your hostilities and aggressions. And yet a civilization couldn't exist where hostilities weren't kept in check. Now, what we do is make it a virtue, in fact, a superior virtue, to keep your hostilities in check.
That is, you would answer Dr. Clark not merely by theological,
mm-hmm. but on his own,
own psychological grounds.
Mm-hmm. Now, but theologically also, I would say that man is a creature of spirit, and we have so many day-to-day case studies of people who have become transformed because of their ability to love. That in the act of attempting to do something that seems to be beyond their reach, that we would say by the grace of God, they actually reach it. Now, it's not a permanent transformation, and this doesn't mean that those of us who are nonviolent don't get mad with our wives or something like this, but at least we have enough experience in coping with our emotions to know that it is to our advantage to control ourselves, that we have gained the most personally, and we've actually made friends with the people that we were at war with. And we're saying that for our movement, we are trying to create a community of love, a redeemed community, no less, where men can live together as brothers. And I've never known brothers to learn to live together by fighting things out. I think that the path of amelioration or of forgiveness in religious language is a much more realistic base for community. Now, we're not really teaching them to love in a sentimental, adoring way. I think maybe he misunderstands the Christian notion of love here a little bit. Yeah, that we're not accepting his behavior, and we're not accepting him as a person in spite of the fact that he's wrong, in spite of the fact that his deeds are savage and bestial. We say that in spite of the way that he is acting at present, he is still a child of God, and if you respond to him as a loving brother, that he can no longer continue to be a savage.
What about this objection that one encounters? It's such a policy and such a philosophy mm-hmm. may work in the South, mm-hmm. where you have some, what you refer to as a religious ethos
yeah.
behind a society.
Mm-hmm.
What about a disoriented non-community like big tracks in Detroit, big tracks in Harlem, big tracks in South Chicago, but the ethos has been lost. But there's no ethos to appeal to.
Well, fortunately, I think we've been able to take our ethos north with us. That the Negroes in Detroit, see, came from the South. And when Martin Luther King came to New York and brought the tremendous mystique and charisma that has been entrusted in him, say, in the Southern movement, these Negroes, a quarter of a million of them, got out and marched behind him in Detroit. And they became a one-day community. Now, all I'm saying is that leadership can make a community of the North, but it's true that as the North exists, see...
You don't see that kind of leadership there, though.
Well, it wasn't in Montgomery until it developed, you see.
I see.
Now, it develops... in part through suffering, that when you've got to the big danger of Northern leadership is that it may not be tempered in time, that any delusions of grandeur that Martin Luther King may have had the first few months were bombed out of him when they bombed his home, and he had to face the fact that you can die doing this, so it's not something to play with. And it pushes him back to new depths. Then you begin to go along a little ways and you're slapped in jail. Some of his great, new ideas of his to his jail periods. Certainly the finest articulation of our whole movement came out of his Birmingham jail experience. And I see that these periods of suffering are a period of great intellectual and spiritual deepening.
You know, I was struck by Cuddy by mm-hmm. going to a rally in Bridgeport where he spoke 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
There was not one person there who was not clearly middle class.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here's a city where this was all isolated.
Mm-hmm. But now, when we began to move a movement, this would have been true in terms of Birmingham if he'd gone there to speak. In fact, he was there about a month before, speaking at an installation service for a minister in the biggest Baptist church there. And that was almost a completely middle-class group. But as the price of suffering and as the movement begins to go, the middle classes thin out and the masses begin to come in.
This is terrible. I'm just beginning to feel we are digging gold now. This is the end of the conversation with Andy Young. This is the end, no more on this tape. The end, no more on this tape. No more on this tape.